Hi everybody, welcome to Turbocharge Your Productivity with Visual Studio. I want to open with a question. Put up your hand if you're a developer or you've worked on developing a software project, so any role in it whatsoever. Keep your hand up if you've had to work late in the last 3 months, last 6 months. Keep your hand up if you enjoyed that. I'm a software developer, I'm a geek, and unlike many, I am proud of it. I've been coding for 30 years. That was my first computer, a ZX81. My parents bought it for me, this was great. They refused to buy any games. So I resorted to typing in games out of magazines, and it all started from there. So you could make the case that my parents have a lot to answer for. These days, one of the major reasons I code, these guys, my kids, my family. Being a developer gives me income, means I can support them, but it also means that I want to get home from work on time. I hate working late. If I have to work late, I miss dinner with the kids, I miss hearing about their day, I miss out on everything that's going on because I get home after they've gone to bed. So I'm really keen on using these tools to do things the most effective way I can so that I get to go home on time and see my family. This is what I'm about with this presentation today, is getting the most out of Visual Studio. So there's our topic. Everybody's in the right room. Let's get started. So I'm going to cover four different areas where you can use Visual Studio. First one I'm going to start with is the environment that you're working in, because if you're a developer, you're spending most of your time in Visual Studio, you want to make sure that that's a comfortable place to work. Next thing I'm going to talk about ways that Visual Studio can help you understand your code base. It's very rare for any of us to be working in a completely greenfields situation. It's far more likely that we're given a code base that's a few years old, it's been worked on by half a dozen people or 60 people or 100 people, and we don't know it like the back of our hands. In fact, there's so much code we can't know it all because it just doesn't fit. So Visual Studio can help us to understand that code. Once we've understood it, we need to get around the code base, get from place to place so that we can get to the code that we need to change. So the next thing I'm going to talk about is navigation within Visual Studio and the way you can get to where you want to go quickly. And then, seemingly last but certainly not least, about writing new code and doing that in an effective way so that it works, it goes, and you get to go home early, or you get to over-deliver and impress the boss. I want to take away three things from this presentation. Hopefully, you'll find one thing where you go, aha, I'm going to start using that tomorrow. I'd also be really pleased if you found one thing that you think, that could be kind of useful. And next week you give it a try, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but you've given it a go. And a couple of the suggestions I'm going to make are a little bit oddball. One person used the term heretic when I suggested one of them. So maybe an experiment to try when you get a bit of time that might work for you, or you might run reeling away and decide, no, not going there again. So, our environment. If we spend all of our time in Visual Studio, it's important that it's an environment that is comfortable for us to work in. So the first thing I want to look at, choose our copy, that one. Oh, small aside, you'll notice some things popping up in the bottom corner. So if I do an Alt-F, you see the Alt-F coming up in the corner of the screen. It's a tool called Karnak that shows all of the keystrokes that I'm using. When I use hotkeys, I'll try to mention what they are, but this provides backup in case I forget and also gives you a way to see what they were and be authoritative on it. So the first thing I want to talk about with Visual Studio, and this is new in Visual Studio 2010, is it actually has a color theme. Let me zoom in. So you have the choice here of a light or a dark theme. This changes more than just the editor settings, which we've been able to change for many versions of Visual Studio. It changes all of the Chrome. So if we change that, whoops, dark, okay, let's zoom back out. And something's crashed. My keyboard tool has crashed. Doesn't like that. So here we go, we've got the dark theme of Visual Studio. Some people say this is far more restful on the eyes. Some people would never work in the light theme again. I'm teetering. I switch backwards and forwards, and I'm still deciding which one I prefer. It is certainly really nice to have that as an option. But for today's presentation, I'm going to switch back to light. And let's try that keyboard tool again and hope it doesn't crash again. The next thing I want to suggest is to be looking at your monitor adjustments. Let's move forward. Monitors, as they come out of the box, are optimized by the manufacturer to look really good at Dick Smith. When you've got a dozen of them all lined up in a row, and you're busy going along thinking, which one should I buy? And the one that's got the bright, vivid colors that looks really, really good is the one that will sell well. Problem is, it's like my moment right now where I'm looking at people and trying to engage and I've got these bright lights in my face. Working all day with a monitor as it comes out of the box, it's like staring into a bright light all day and it can fatigue your eyes and things. So tune your monitor, make it comfortable. The biggest tip that I've had on it was to hold up a pad of paper next to your screen, and if the screen is brighter than the paper, it's too bright. You want to back it down. Simple thought, but it can make a big difference. Next thing I want to talk about is your choice of font in Visual Studio. Now, quite aside from the oft-repeated advice that you should be going with Lucida Console 16-point when you're doing a presentation, did you notice that on the font screen here, it lists all of these other fonts as well? These are all proportional fonts, and they work just fine. The fact that we use monospaced fonts for development is an artifact of history. The first printers were automated typewriters. Typewriters were built with monospaced fonts because the technology wasn't there to do proportional ones. Then we got punched cards, and everything had to line up in columns. And when we got to terminals and consoles, they repeated that because they were bringing forward the old ideas into new space. We don't have to stick with fixed-width fonts. In fact, if I make a quick switch here, if we go for Calibri and 16, that code is eminently readable. And with the automatic indentation that Visual Studio does for us, most things will work just fine. So take that away, give it a try. I've mostly switched to using a proportional font in all my development, and it works. It's easy to read. Proportional fonts are provably easier to read, faster to read. The studies that I've read have indicated that it is as much as a 20% speed improvement on reading a proportional font versus a monospaced one. And since what we do a lot of the time is reading our code, it can make a big difference. However, I was warned that if I tried to do the presentation with a proportional font, I'd probably have some encounter with rotten vegetables, so I'm going to switch back, just to keep you comfy. Okay, so, you with me so far? Say something? Excellent, this is good. Next thing I want to talk about is the layout of Visual Studio itself. We've got all of these sidebars that hang around. You know, we've got Code Analysis, Solution Explorer, Team Explorer for TFS, Properties, all these ones over here and a bunch down here as well. And they all take space on screen. If you have a tool that you want to use, by all means leave it there. If you have something you never ever touch, close it, get rid of it. Make every pixel on screen work for you. If you are blessed with a full HD 27-inch screen, then peg a few of them open so that you can see what's going on. make it work for you. Now, there's a catch here that in some ways the window layouts are a bit fragile. It's easy for them to get compromised. There's a way to deal with that. You go to the Tools menu, and you go to Import and Export Settings, and say we want to do an export. Turn everything off, and then dive in under General Settings, and right down the bottom, you can select just the window layouts. Then you can export the layouts that you like into a file and preserve them. Then if they get mangled up for some reason, you can just import them again and everything goes back the way you want. Saves futzing around with dragging and dropping all the time if somebody else comes and uses your environment and closes something or whatever. Useful? That particular function is available in Windows 2010 as well. Obviously, I'm using 2012 here. I'm not sure about 2008. I couldn't find an install of that to check on. Does anybody know? I'll take that as a not. Okay. It's the wrong slide deck. Here we go. So you'll notice everything is here in the slide deck. So when you go and download it, you'll have all of the details of the tips that I've shown you, even though I'm showing them to you in Visual Studio rather than with the slides. So the next thing I want to talk about is understanding a code base. You've switched projects, the boss has said, hey, we've got this urgent problem in production, there's a bug fix, you've got to go fix it, and you've never seen the code base before. How can you effectively work out what's there and how it works? First thing you can do, so if we go in here to my fractal frame, so this is an interface that identifies an area of the screen in which I want to draw a fractal. And I know the bug that I have is something to do with the width, so I go here, and you can do let's check my notes, find a symbol to find all the uses of a particular symbol. Now the simple short key for this is Shift F12, and it goes through all of the files in your solution. And last time I tried this, it was much faster. Another keystroke for it that often works is Control K, Control R. It was faster last time, honest. It's interesting. Visual Studio is busy. Don't you love it when the demo goes south like this? The idea of the find symbol is that it actually finds uses of that actual symbol. It's not doing a text search. So any other width that is defined in my code base is not going to be found. There we go. There's all the results. You can see everywhere that it's used. Find one that looks interesting, double click on it, and you go there. And the symbol results stay in the sidebar so you can work your way through them to check each one. If you've got ReSharper installed, which is a pretty cool tool, I don't have it here. It does the same thing with the find symbol, but it's a little deluxe. So worth having a look at. Thought I had that written down here. Let's double check. Think it's a context menu. So if we go back to where we were, so Control minus takes us back. Right click on this. There's find references. Control KR. Yep, there we go. Find simple results. It'd be better if they were more consistent with the naming, but that's the one, find references. I think it's under the edit menu as well. But I'm not seeing it on a quick scan. So. All right, good question, thank you. Okay. On a similar kind of idea, there's another one that's quite referenced. So if we come to the frame renderer and look at my render function, this is the one that actually draws the fractal on screen. And we want to see, where is this called from? Well, you can right-click on this and choose View Call Hierarchy. Now, the keys for this are Control-K, Control-T, or Control-W, Control-K. I don't know quite who invents these things. And we can see calls to render, where it comes from, and calls from render. And you can drill down the hierarchy to see the entire call tree and how things are interacting. Very, very useful if you identify that the bug is happening in this routine, but that's because it's being given bad data, and you can drill up to see what's going on. Now that's more than kind of useful. I've used it to solve some hairy problems. There are other things you can do. How many of you have used Visual Studio's class diagrams? Show of hands. Smattering, this is good. So if we come over to the Solution Explorer, and we'll add one in. So we'll add a new item. And we'll make a class diagram. Now these are kind of like UML style class diagrams, but they're not quite. The nice thing is that most of what's in the diagram is automatically maintained for you by Visual Studio. So if we come in here and we drag in our fractal frame, we see the class, we see all the properties, and what's going on. If we pull in the renderer, you can see what it's doing. And it contains a list of pixels, which we can show as a collection association, brings up that. And so we're starting to build up a picture that describes our code base and what's going on. Now, obviously, I'm just plopping things on here without paying too much care with them. But I'm sure you can see that a well-designed class diagram can be a very good entry point for someone to understand your code base. You can lay things out, and from the toolbox, you can add in comments. And then you've got something which actually can serve as documentation for someone who's trying to get their head around how a particular module works. What's really nice, as I alluded to before, is that Visual Studio maintains this. If you add new methods or new properties to the classes, when someone comes back to this diagram, it's automatically updated. So maybe they'll have to move things that have started to overlap. But very, very simple to put together and very useful for someone coming to get their hands on the code. Moving along the same sort of continuum of having a diagram that explains our code, anyone familiar with UML sequence diagrams? Again, a smattering of hands. Don't seem to be quite the same hands as class diagrams. So if we go to the fractal frame, no, my notes are wrong. Let's go to the renderer. So got a complex method here. You want to think, oh, geez, what the heck does this thing actually do? Well, if you've got the ultimate edition of Visual Studio, and unfortunately this is an ultimate edition feature, you can go to your architecture. Is it architecture? And generate a sequence diagram. I'm not seeing it on the menu here. That's interesting. Here we go, on the right-click menu, generate sequence diagram. And you say, we're going to do two levels of call depth, so the things we call are the things they call. And we're going to do everything in the current solution, and we're going to leave, you know, properties and the system namespace out. And what this does is it goes away, and it does humongous amounts of analysis, and it generates a complete sequence diagram that shows how this object, this method, interacts with other objects to get the job done. And if we have a look at this,
It's actually kind of long.
So it shows the whole thing in one place. And you see the loops and the ifs and the conditions and everything else coming into play. So it's the sort of thing that, again, can be a really useful entry point for someone to look at your code base and understand what's going on. So if you are picking up a code base and you find a key method, this can be a good way to get something that you print out on paper and then study to see how these objects are all interacting. I've used this a handful of times because it is slightly cumbersome, and I've found it extraordinarily useful the times I have used it. So it probably means I should be using it more often. Who's tried that one out? What do you think of it? Okay, so the next thing I want to look at is navigation. So we've done call hierarchies. Oh, I hate PowerPoint. All right, next thing I want to talk about is getting around in your code base, going from place to place so that you can get to the code that you need to without losing your context. You know, have you ever had that experience where you think, okay, I need to get to this point, and by the time you get there, it's 15 minutes later, and you think, okay, I'm here, now what was I going to do? Is it just me, or does that happen to other people as well? There's a few people nodding very quietly. Okay. So first thing I want to point out here is a really cool feature that's kind of new to Visual Studio 2012. It's up here in the corner. It's the Quick Launch. And this gives you quick navigation to all the features that are in Visual Studio. And this is golden. Because I don't know about you guys, but sometimes when I've got all of these menus and an options dialog that's got 1,100 different options pages, finding the one I want can be a pain. So what you can do here is you just type in what you're looking for. So if we go font, it shows environments and fonts. And better yet, you can just click on it and it takes you straight there. Great time saver. Another one, if you go and you search for analysis, it shows you everything to do with analysis, and it shows you the hotkeys to start it. So if it's a function you go to regularly and you can find it, you can find the hotkey, remind yourself of how it works, and start getting more effective by using the hotkey to activate it each time. Now, in Visual Studio 2010, they prototyped this feature with the productivity power tools that you could download and install. And if you've got it installed, then under your view menu, you've got a quick access dialog, which is effectively the same thing. It's just done by a plugin, and it behaves in pretty much the same way. So if you're still using Visual Studio 2010, which I'm sure lots of you are, then that's a really, really good add-in to put into place. The ReSharper shortcut keys, I don't know. I haven't installed ReSharper on a machine with Visual Studio 2012. I suspect for the quick access one for 2010 probably doesn't. I don't know about the 2012 one. But I'll make a note to find out. Okay, the next thing, and this is one that I probably should have known sooner, but didn't. Scott Hanselman showed it to me when he came over to Webstock. Control comma lets you navigate to stuff. How many of you knew about that one? Fewer than I thought. This is really, really good. So let me switch back to 2012, and we'll do control comma, brings it up. So you can type in the name of the thing you want to navigate to, so like fractal frame, and it does the find. Let me zoom in so that's a bit easier to see. So fractal frame brings it up, works really well. But more than that, it searches for methods, not just objects and interfaces. So it drills down inside the objects and finds them based on the name. Better yet, it knows about the conventions we developers usually use, where we reuse the same words over and over in different combinations. So it actually knows about camel case. So if I put an FF, it finds fractal frame and get factory four frame and those as well. So now with just three or four keystrokes, you can find the thing you're looking for and go straight there. Boom. Really, really useful and has saved me a lot of time since I learned it. It was one of these ones I wish I'd known earlier. Next idea is the Solution Explorer. Now, the Solution Explorer itself has been around since before it was Visual Studio, when it was Visual InterDev and when it was VBA inside Excel 97. We had the Solution Explorer. What they've done with this release is they've revved it up, and it's really rather cool. Notice we've now got a search box at the top here. Let me zoom in so it's a bit easier to see. Oops. So we've got this search box at the top where we can type stuff into search. So as we did before, we can type in frame, and it does the search and finds us everything called with frame in its name anywhere in the solution. It also is aware of Pascal case. So PS finds point sequences. And very usefully, I've had a number of problems and projects that could have been solved with this. If you type in the name of something, it'll find referenced assemblies with that name. Now that can be magic when you get have you ever had the, words are failing me, the error when you compile that it tells you that there's another version of the same referenced assembly and it wants to do the override thing in your app.config and you're thinking, it's just a project in the solution, there should be only one. With this, you can find all the references and work out which one's no longer a project reference and has become an assembly reference, and you can go and fix it. Really, really sweet. Really, really useful. Now, if you are a Visual Studio 2010 user, you do get to play with this because they've added, through the Productivity Power Pack, the Solution Navigator, which is effectively the prototype for this feature, and it works basically the same as what I've just shown you. Very, very useful. And if you don't have it, I would suggest go get it. Now, there's a couple of other things about this that are really useful. One of them is, where are we? I can never find the one I want. The filter here. Now, if you're using TFS, it can show you just the files that have been changed and need to be checked in. Even if you're not using TFS, though, this one's useful. It only shows you the files that are open. So if you know the files already open, or just as a convenient way to navigate amongst them. So let's close a few. And as I close these, you'll be able to see the list getting smaller. So that's a really useful way for navigating around because it still maintains the hierarchy of your solution, breaking it down project by project. And it's therefore a much more useful way than this linear alphabetical list that we've had for many releases. Another thing which is really useful, and now this is a personal taste one, if we go into, we'll use the quick launch. Go into projects and solutions in general in the options. There's an option here, track active item in Solution Explorer. When that's on, as you change from file to file, the selection in the Solution Explorer will update for the file that you're currently looking at. Now, I'm not sure that it's showing very well here. There we go. As I change tab, you can see the selection changing on the side. Now, that can be really, really useful for all sorts of reasons. And again, is one that I tend to have turned on all of the time. I turned it off at the start of this so I could show you where it was. How many of you think you might use that one? Lots of hands. Great. Okay, the next thing I want to talk about, and I'm going to skip the PowerPoint and just keep going here, is about writing more code more effectively. So if we go to here, where we have a blank solution, there's a number of things in Visual Studio that help you write code more effectively. Let's just tweak the font up here. Interesting. Okay, so who here knows about code snippets? Keep your hands up if you use them. That's reasonable. The rest of you are in for a treat. These things are really, really powerful. So we've got a brand new project here, just a class library for demo purposes. First thing I'm going to do is I'm going to rename the file from class 1 to person. Now I'm doing it by renaming the file because by doing that, Visual Studio notices the file change and says, do you want to change the class as well? So I say yes. If you just rename the class, it doesn't rename the file, but useful to do it that way. Now, this is we're wanting to model details about a person in our system. So we want to add some properties to capture their name and other details about them. Now, we could write the code by hand, but let's use some snippets. So the long way to use a snippet is you right-click where you want it, and you go to Insert Snippet, and you get this little thing up here, and you drill down the menu, and you find the one you want, and you click on it, and by the time you do that, you've forgotten what you want to do. Much faster way, I mean, you can do Control-K-X, and insert the snippet and get the menu that saves using the context menu, but it's also really, really slow. The best way to do it, when you know the snippet you want, is just to type its name. So, Prop-G. Then you press tab, and it expands it in the spot. So it's really quick, always at hand. So let's have a string property, and we'll have the person's full name. We'll do it again. And we'll have their family name. And what they're known as, in case that's not the same. Let's also put in their age. Excuse me. So, a little bit of code written very, very quickly. Let's just capture details about a particular person. So, we'll say we've got that. Let's add another class. Now, I'm using the idea here that we're doing some kind of a view model that goes along with creating a WPF or a Windows 8 or some forms of ASP web page. The exact details are not too important. What I want you to focus on is the process I'm going through to write the code. So we've got our view model. It's public. And we're going to implement the notify property changed interface so that it behaves well with the usual data binding. We type that in. We use control full stop to bring up the menu from the smart tag. Let's zoom in. You see just underneath the eye, we've got the little blue rectangle showing up. That's a smart tag that says the IDE has a suggestion for us. We can do a control full stop. It drops down. And we say, okay, we want to be using system component model, and that all now works. over in the toolbox, Visual Studio is messing with me because I had the code I wanted on the toolbox and it's gone away. Wonderful. So let's implement it by hand. Drop that down again. We'll say we'll implement the interface. There we go. So we need the private member to store it. And we need our add and also we need our triggering method. So we'll follow the usual practice here, where we grab a copy of it, so that if some other thread changes our subscriptions in mid-flight, we don't have a problem. And if we have some handlers, what's the property name? And it hates me. Why does it hate me? This is why I had the canned code to bring across. I'm kind of frustrated that it dropped off, but it will work. Okay, so now we've got that, and we need to create some method. We need to mirror the methods from our original person over here so that we can not having that code has flustered me. Okay, we need to mirror the methods across here, but we need them to be property changed properties that are going to fire the notification property properly. It's almost like it's dropped all of my things. Right, so what I had here, which has dropped off, was in the same way that you can have a property that expands, I actually had a prop n, which has dropped off, that would expand to the full property changed, property notifying property, so that everything was data bindable and everything. So I'll just write one of them by hand to show you what it looked like. And obviously, if the snippet was writing this for me, I would be done already. Nothing kills a presentation like writing lots of code in full sight of the audience. Right, so there we go, we've written one, and with the magic of snippets, I was going to have written about five of these in half that time, and it would have all been rather impressive, and unfortunately, it's not. Next thing we can do though, so if we just cheat, I'll declare the other private members, and we'll just pretend that the properties are there. Export snippets. The snippets are stored as XML files that you just drop into the right place in the file system. There is, under Tools, the Snippets Manager. With the Snippets Manager, you add the directory that your snippets are living in, and it automatically scans them and makes them available. And what has happened in my installation here, for some reason, is it seems to have dropped off the folder that I had my snippets in. But I won't try and deal with that now because digging through the file system is hardly entertaining. You just add them in here and you can put them in. There is a little IDE, if you get serious about snippets, that you can download, and it just helps you write them and test them. But they're basically an XML file with a pretty simple layout, and you can write your own ones fairly easily. The first time I did it, it took me about 10 minutes. Reasonably straightforward. Thanks for the question. So we've got three variables here now, the full name, the family name, and known as. Now, say that we have a display method that takes one of our person objects, and we want to take all of the information off that person and put it into our properties so that it's going to display in the UI. And we also want to have a save method that's going to take all of our properties that we've data bound and copy them onto the underlying object. Now, it's pretty simple code, but we also don't have to write it the hard way. So let's zoom in a little here. So we've got three properties we want to copy. Full name, family name, and known as. Now, how many of you have used column select in Visual Studio? Smattering your hands, this is good. So what you can do is if you hold down the Alt key and then drag, you start selecting a rectangle of code instead of contiguous lines. And you can copy that. Then you can paste it, which gives us something that looks kind of odd. But if you do a selection across multiple lines, you can then actually start typing. Bring that across. Oh, people like that one. Usually gets a good response. So if we do the same over here, so tab across, select those, type a semicolon, control K, control D to reformat the code, and we've written the code to copy all of our properties across in one go. Now, less impressive with just three, but you can imagine if you had a dozen to write, suddenly you've saved yourself 10 minutes. Now, because our properties aren't actually there, sure. Yes, it does work with a proportional font. Even though the lines may not quite line up, it does work. So to make that work, let's make those use the member variables. So when we're doing the save and we're copying the information back the other way, similar sort of idea. Now, I'm just going to line these up manually, but there are actually add-ins for Visual Studio that will do this for you to line everything up on equals. Now the reason I'm doing that is I want to completely reverse this around. So what we can do is we can actually copy all of those. So again, holding down Alt while I do the drag, copy those, put them at the start, paste them in. And because we're using, got the properties missing, we'll just correct those. And we're as good as done, except for the fact we need to put those in. The set accessor is inaccessible. Ah, because they're private sets. And there you go. So what do we see there? We saw property snippets that didn't work, but trust me, they do, can be very useful. One snippet that I have used that is really, really useful and has disappeared from here. You know when you're writing iDisposable and the common pattern is you have a dispose method and then there's a private that takes a boolean that says whether or not to do the manage things is, or not, and that whole thing, I've got a snippet that I use whenever I'm doing that that does the whole thing, including creating the destructor and the suppress finalize, and it just puts it in and gets it right every time. Really quite useful. What I'll do is I'll throw these snippets that I couldn't demonstrate today, I'll throw them up in my blog. The link's coming up later in the presentation, so you'll be able to see those and give them a go when you're back at work. Right, moving on from the failed demos, let's go back to the Mandelbrot screensaver. How many of you use unit tests? N unit, X unit, MB unit, even MS test? Anybody? Yep. New in Visual Studio 2010 is this Test Explorer. And this thing is rather nice. So you write your tests, and this is built in. The thing is, the tests I have in this project are written with NUnit, and Visual Studio supports those tests. The way it works is that it's all pluggable. So if we have a look in the Extensions Manager, I've installed the NUnit test adapter. This empowers Visual Studio to do the Test Explorer, to show me that sidebar, for NUnit tests. Now, most of the popular frameworks, MBUnit, XUnit, and so on, have these adapters already available, so you can work within the standard Visual Studio tools with the test framework that you prefer. You can even have multiple test runners installed, and they all just integrate in really nicely. It's really slick, and for me, it was totally unexpected. Now, let's take one of the tests we've got here, and I'm just going to break it. I'm going to do a build, Control-Shift-B, and watch what happens. Did you see that the Test Explorer showed the failure straight away? Up here, let me zoom in. The top of the Test Explorer, there's an option to automatically run the tests after a build. Now, it doesn't make them a part of the build process, so when you're automating your builds with TFS, or Team City, or Cruise Control, it's not going to run the test automatically as part of the build. But it does trigger all of the tests immediately after the build and update there automatically. So if we change this back and we do another build, and the tests pass. So this can be really, really great to just have Doc there. You're working away, doing what you're normally doing. If you do something rash that breaks a test, you're going to find out about it. Now, there's those who would argue you should be doing TDD and so on. It's not always practical. Of course, I would say that if you can do it, you should. But the nice thing is you can always be confident your tests are passing. It's no longer a separate step. Really, really useful. Who thinks they might use that one? Excellent. Now, how many of you do code reviews, actually have somebody else look at your code before it gets checked in? More hands than I expected. It's becoming more popular. This is good. A lot of the time, though, people object to code reviews, saying that it doesn't deliver value or it takes too long. Well, using code analysis in Visual Studio gives you something that's kind of the same. It's not going to find design flaws. It's just going to be really, really nitpicky that you're doing things in what's known to be a good way. Now, code analysis hides under the Analyze menu. So you can run code analysis and get it to tweak your environment. No, it's not quite right. You can get it to comment on your code and train you to write better code. That's the best way to do it. Not to treat it as something you come along later and fix up, but run it all of the time and let it train you into writing better code that doesn't have some common flaws. Now, most people hate code analysis for two reasons. It's noisy and chatty, that's one reason, and it takes too long. Now, there are ways to solve those. Let me show you. We go into the Solution Explorer and go into the properties for the project and the code analysis tab. This is where you configure code analysis. And you'll notice that what it says here is it says run the rule set niche, which is my rule set. How did I do that? I hit the wrong key. Right. What you do is you go to open, that's the wrong key. You go to choose a rule set and you say choose multiple rule sets. And it comes up with this dialog. And I would say just turn them all on. And then you do a save as. And what it does is it creates a rule set file. I always put this at the root of my solution, and I check it in the source control. Then you can select it by using browse, and once it's chosen, you can open it. And this is where the power comes in. If you are writing internal code that is never going to be seen outside your organization, you probably don't care about globalization. You can turn it off. If you are particularly fussy that you like to expose generic lists, you can turn off that rule. So you can customize the code analysis rules for your environment, for the way you do things where you are. So if you don't like a rule and you're never going to adhere to it, turn it off, it'll stop bugging you. You can customize it and it works really, really well. Now the other thing people complain about is that the code analysis takes too long, runs a lot of extra code, it does a lot of analysis. Here's the trick. Go into your configuration manager for your build, and in addition to the debug and release builds, make an analysis build. Leave your debug build set to do the minimum that produces code that works. It produces all of the debugging symbols. Create an analysis build that does a debug build plus and adds in the code analysis. Then, when you're doing your TDD or whatever your cycle is, you can switch to the debug build and you get fast builds. Gives you the feedback you need. And then when you finish a feature and you're ready to commit it, or you finish a little step, you're not going to commit it, but you just want to check where you are, you can switch to the analysis build and do that build, and then pay the performance of waiting for the longer build. You can see this is taking quite a bit longer, but you're not paying that for every single build, so you get the best of both worlds. Make sense? Lots of nodding heads, this is good. So you're looking down here, you can see a bunch of warnings in here. I have been deliberately messy with this code, so I would have some warnings to show you. Now there's a few things here, like identifiers should be spelled correctly. You can go and Google that and find out how you can make a custom dictionary that is a part of your project, and then the way you spell things, the abbreviations you use in your business, can all be known to code analysis and they'll stop complaining about them. The other thing you can do is you can suppress messages if they are truly bogus, and you can do it in source or a suppression file. So if we do it in source code and see what it's doing, is it's just put in an attribute that says we're suppressing that message. Now what I would suggest is that if you do that, let's format this so it's all a little bit more visible. There's an optional thing as a part of the attribute called justification. And I would suggest if you do this, just take a minute to explain why. Then somebody coming along later will be able to say, oh, that's a good reason, instead of this guy was smoking something, and take it out and then have problems. Very, very simple things, but what you can do is you can take the idea of code analysis and embrace it without paying the price in noisy messages, without paying the price in slow compilation times. So who thinks they might give code analysis a try? Good on you. Okay, something else to look at is, now let me back up a sec. Who of you has heard of Dave Allen, the GTD guy, getting things done? Two hands. Okay, you should go Google him. His core concept of personal productivity is that it's a bad idea to keep everything in your head because heads leak. If you keep it on paper, if you make an authoritative list that has everything, you can relax, not worry about forgetting things, and spend all of your time focusing on what you're doing. Now, strangely enough, there's support in Visual Studio to do exactly that. So if you go to the View menu, there's this thing called the Task List, and it has an option to show user tasks out of TFS or comments. So this is picking up on comments that I've written in my code where I've marked things as to do. So I can leave myself notes through my code as to things I need to do, need to come back to, and the task list will show them to me. Now better than that, if we go to the quick launch, we go to tasks here, you can choose the token list to put in there. So there's a few I always add in. I always add in bug, and I always add in perf. Because sometimes I have to get something done, it has to go, but I know that if it's not, I shouldn't have clicked OK on that, I forgot to click add. But I know that what I've done is not optimal, and it might become a performance bottleneck. So I leave myself hints for the future that if I find it is actually a performance bottleneck, I can come back, read the note, say, ah, fix it, and look smart. So you put those in, and the task list will show any that you've now tagged with those tags. Really useful. Now, if you've got a team of developers, you might want to agree on some standard tags and put them in, and everybody uses the same ones. It searches through, I think, open files. That's correct. I find it most useful when I have a performance problem or a bug and I'm getting familiar with the code base again that maybe I haven't looked at in 6 months. Then they give me tips about what's been left, what's the technical debt that's outstanding there. I believe so, yes. I would need to test it to be sure. Okay, now another thing that can go on. So if we go into Frame Renderer, now we say we're looking at this code and we're thinking, what's going on? We need to know about what is point to calculate and what does it mean. So we set a breakpoint and we run. We get to here, and we look at point to calculate. Now, let me zoom in and bring that up again. Can you see how point to calculate is showing me the 0, 0 by 16? What I've done with point to calculate is at the top of it, I've got this debugger display attribute, which controls how the debugger displays one of those instances when it's on screen. So instead of just getting class mesh point, which is completely useless, then this shows you exactly the properties that are useful. You can name the properties, you can format it any way you like, and that's really useful. Now more than that, you can come back here, say I want to see point to calculate every time, so I'm going to pin it. And what it does is it actually pins that on the canvas next to the code. And it stays there. So every time I come back to this, it's going to update and show me exactly what's going on. Now that's useful. Even better, you can toggle it down and you can add a comment as to why you've got it there and remind yourself. So when you're doing complex debugging, it can save you a lot of time drilling down into things. The other reason to use debugger display is if you're looking at a list of things, this is going to work. Normally when you look into a list of things, you see mesh point, mesh point, mesh point, mesh point. If you're using debugger display, you can actually see the details of each one on the list. So if you're pulling a list of things out of a database and you want to be able to go to the one for John Smith, you can make it much easier to find that one you need when you're doing your debugging. They're stored in one of the SUO file, the solution options file, along with all of your window settings and what files you've got open. So they are semi-persistent. That's right. All right. So let's go back to PowerPoint. PowerPoint hates me. So, those were the four areas we went through. Improving your environment, how to understand code, how to get around in your code, and with some problems with snippets, how to write code more effectively. I hope that all of you have got three things out of this presentation, something to use, something to try, and maybe something experimental, maybe the proportional fonts. If you want to get a hold of me, There's some details if you want some related sessions. There's some ideas. And if anyone's got some cards, we'll do a draw in a couple of minutes. Thank you very much.